Hi there, everybody, and welcome to Maybe Next Year. We're going to start episode 7 this evening. We have, I'm your host, Corey Foster, my co-host here, Ethan Vober. And tonight for our Vikings segment, we have special guest, my brother-in-law from all the way over in Rosemont, Minnesota, Jake Gobb. Hi, Jake. You want to say a little howdy to the folks out there in a little intro?
Hey, everyone. Thanks for having me. My name is Jake Gobb. Like Corey said, I live over in Rosemont. I have lived in Minnesota every second of my life, so I'm a hometown kid, big-time homer. Absolutely love the Vikes, so I'm super excited that Corey asked me to be on and get a little pep talk and cheer for my boys. So,
yeah, like I was saying, you're definitely probably one of the more positive fans that we've had on, so that'll be good. Definitely take an optimistic viewpoint that not a lot of Vikings fans, I think, probably have in their fandom. So just a quick overview for what we're going to do tonight here. Be sure, usually about a half hour after we're done taping and have it uploaded, it'll be, available on Anchor and then into Spotify as well. Just go into Spotify and search Maybe Next Year and it'll pop up there for you along with our first 6 episodes. So feel free to, catch up on those if you get a chance to. For tonight, what we have planned, we're going to start with the Vikings here. We'll talk a little bit about the, Vikings and Bears game. Our analysis of it and some of our thoughts kind of briefly there, because what we're going to spend most of the time on the Vikings segment is previewing the playoff game for tomorrow night, or tomorrow afternoon, I should say. It's at noon, the Vikings and the Saints, and some of our keys to the game there, and then maybe just a brief look kind of at the rest of the NFC field, and then maybe our overall picks as well for the playoffs. Second segment, we'll have Dave Scogan's going to come in and join us for that. We're going to talk a little bit about the Twins and their signings of the past week. They had a couple significant signings. We'll discuss those and any impact that they might have on the upcoming 2020 season. And we'll finish up with the last sports segment we'll do is on the Gophers football team, who had a huge, huge victory this past week in the Outback Bowl, and we'll talk about that a little bit. And then we will finish up with our bowl predictions for the week. So, starting here, we'll first take a look at the Vikings-Bears game from last Sunday. It wasn't a pretty one, and I don't think anybody really thought it was going to be a pretty one, knowing that it was mostly going to be subs, second-teamers, third-teamers, like that. And it kind of played out like we thought it would. They ended up losing 21-19, and probably a little bit closer than I would have initially wagered if you would have looked at the starting, who they were starting, and what they were going against. But I think that tells you a little bit about where the Bears are at, too, that they struggled against that group of Vikings. But a loss nonetheless. It didn't affect anything. You know, they were going to be a 6th seed no matter what. They couldn't control who they were going to play by winning or losing. The game itself, Sean Mannion, I don't know if we have any Sean Mannion fans out there, but he went 12 for 21 for 126 yards and 2 picks. Wasn't terrible. Didn't make any fantastic throws or wow you, but kind of was just a manager. The one highlight to bright spot for the Vikings, though, was Mike Boone, the running back, who carried for 117 carries for 148 yards and a couple of really impressive runs. But he had an up-and-down day. He had some great runs, but he fumbled one after a big run in the first quarter and then had a really kind of odd interception where he bobbled the ball and it looked like he was almost handing it off to the to the receiver. I thought it looked like he might be part of like a Black Sox fix or something at one point where he was handing the ball away. But, okay, so, you know, and then Mitch Trubisky on the other end, kind of that big – he's always the talking point whenever you talk about the Bears, and I know that he's really controversial there and whether they want to keep him or not. But he was 26 for 37 for 207, no touchdowns, interceptions, was kind of unspectacular as well. And, you know, if you're a Bears fan, I don't know how you're feeling about him going forward, but – okay, so I guess the question then, and I'll ask you guys, well, first, Jake, was there anything that stood out to you as you kind of watched the game on Sunday?
To be honest with you, I can't say I even remember much about the Bears game. I'm still pretty bitter about Green Bay the week before that and the curse of Kirk Cousins on Monday night. But, yeah, to me, the Bears game was pointless, and I completely agree with sitting starters. I don't really think that has any impact rolling into the playoffs or anything. Better to rest them.
So you don't think after playing as poorly as they did against the Packers the week before that maybe shouldn't have had them in there for a series or two and help them get moving and maybe feel a little bit better about themselves?
Absolutely not. Those guys are professionals. They don't need a drive in an exhibition game to get them pumped up.
Yeah,
practice is just fine for him.
What do you think, Ethan?
That's fair. I mean, I personally, and I don't coach in the NFL, I play a lot of Madden, but I probably would have had him in maybe first quarter just to get him in there and get, you know, it's whatever. It's a great point. They're professionals and they get paid a lot of money to go play when they're supposed to play. But I think there was a lot of injuries and there was a lot of stuff, and I don't have any problem with him sitting him, and I think it was probably pretty smart. But me personally, I probably would have seen him out there for a quarter, maybe a half. But like you said, the game's absolutely worthless. It was lackluster. It was pointless to even watch.
Well, let's put it this way then. Let's say the Packers were in a similar situation and they had a game that was not going to determine whether they were playing, or, you know, who they were playing or what seed they were playing or their home or away. Would you have run Aaron Rodgers out there for the first quarter?
I don't think you would. Well, in my eyes, Rodgers is worth a lot more than Cousins. But I could see both ways. I don't know. I guess without trying to be a hypocrite, then I'd say I would have probably liked to see him out there a quarter, but injuries and keeping him healthy, there was no reason to.
Yeah.
Especially with Khalil Mack running around out there.
That's true. And before we go to the Vikings Saints preview or whatever, the only question I was going to ask outside of that was an article that came out yesterday or the day before, where the Wilfs came out in support and said that regardless of what happens tomorrow or the rest of the playoffs, that both Mike Zimmer and Rick Spielman will be coming back next year. And, you know, we had mentioned last week, I think when we talked, that at least my thinking was that if they go and they get blown out tomorrow, that it might be a little iffy about whether or not they're going to decide to bring Zimmer and Spielman back. So, you know, Jake, do you think it's a good move to come out before this game even and to say that no matter what happens, that those two are going to be back?
I don't know about publicly saying that stuff. Maybe just to settle the media and the public and the fans from getting all over it. But I don't know, in my perspective, I think Spielman and Zimmer are amongst us positive Vikings fans. They are very well liked, especially Spielman. I mean, if you look at him compared to the other organizations in Minnesota, year in and year out, Spielman puts together a team that at least will be pushing for the playoffs and hopefully putting together a team that at the beginning of the year or throughout the year could be talked about in the Super Bowl, whereas, you know, other GMs and ownership groups in Minnesota, they just kind of they beat around the bush and never give you a firm answer. But the Wilfs are always about winning, and Spielman is as well. So I absolutely love those guys. So I'm jacked up that they said that they're going to be coming back for sure, because, you know, Spielman, he's going all in every year.
Yeah, it is. You know, I think it's probably nice for some fandom to have that, you know, continuity and even on bad years and things that keeping some kind of consistency to it is a big part of it. But we've definitely seen cases where owners have come out and said coaches are fine and GMs are fine, and then a week later they're not fine. But
yeah, I mean, what good is it going to do to say that they're in the hot seat right now?
Especially in a week getting ready for, like, they were probably not a positive yeah. thing. So, all right. So getting to the big part of it, the preview for the Vikings Saints game tomorrow. You know, I'm not sure there's a lot of the basic facts that we could give that you probably don't already know. You know, Saints coming in at 13-3, they are 8-point favorites. And we all know that going to New Orleans is not a fun place to play with the crowd and things there. Breeze is actually 6-1 at home over Saints career, which goes all the way back to 06. I was a little shocked when I saw it's been that long, but yeah, all the way back to 06. But 1-5 on the road, which I thought was an interesting stat. Him and the Saints are rolling right now, and I think that's what makes him so scary. And we talked about that a little bit last week. He's breezed through 15 touchdowns with no picks in December, you know, so he had just an unreal last month. So as much as the Vikings might be scuffling a little bit going into the playoffs, they're kind of on the other end of it rolling. Dalvin Cook is supposedly back at full strength, is everything that we've been told, is that he is healthy. Which obviously is huge for the offense and what they are able to do or not do. But it's also important to note that the Saints are actually the number one running defense in the NFL over the last 2 years. which is interesting because you don't, I think when you think about the Saints, you don't typically think defense. You know, so when we talk about matchups a little bit, that'll definitely be one of the matchups to take a look at. Other things, you know, going forward, I think we'll talk about some of the keys to winning and things like that. But I guess what I'll open it up to you guys first and foremost is, what are some things, what are some matchups that you think, either are positives for the Vikings or things that, that might be a little bit troublesome, Ethan?
I think just overall New Orleans defense, like you said, they're super aggressive. Cook's going to have to get going early to help, Cousins do what he's going to need to do. And we talked about it last week that Cousins thrown one interception all year on play action, but for play action to be so successful, their running backs have to make it successful. And that starts at the O-line as well. And that's picking up blitzes and everything. And then it just translates into your receivers that are going to have to get open. Thielen's going to have to get the ball. Diggs is going to have to get the ball. Cousins is going to have to be smart with it and getting them the ball. But I think primarily it's going to start with Cook getting hot early and keeping the defense that's so aggressive on their heels. And they're not going to be able to just guess what's going to happen next when it's third and 13. So I think that's going to be a big key of the game is Cook or whoever. I mean, they have a lot of good running backs. Madison
should be okay.
So if he's coming back too, you know, there's no reason why the run game can't get started and take a little bit of load off of Cousins, get to work maybe later on, and then work and play action too. So that's my key right away is they need to get that going.
What are your important matchups, Jake?
You know, the biggest thing that scares me looking at the New Orleans Saints is obviously Drew Brees down the last stretch. How you said he had 15 touchdowns and no picks. Just watching him week in and week out, it's downright scary. And I know for Vikings fans going into the last couple of weeks of playoff, it was obviously the only team we didn't want to play.
Yep.
But if you look historically, I think the Vikings have done pretty darn good against New Orleans. I mean, heads up, you know, we've fared well. But they are very intimidating. Playing in their stadium, almost every single team will say they have great home field advantage. You know, their stadium's great, their fans are great, but I think New Orleans is one where it truly means something, and that is a dangerous place to play. I think that right there is probably their biggest advantage over the Vikings. I'm a firm believer that every single person on the Vikes is going to show up and play, and when it comes down to man-to-man, position-to-position, that the Vikes are going to prevail. I see no reason why our O-line's not going to show up and Kirk's going to burn him deep. Cook, you know, like Ethan said, has got to get going right away.
So you trust the O-line then, huh?
What?
You trust the O-line then?
Absolutely. Yeah. They were great all season long until Green Bay on Monday night in week 16. Until that game, until we got embarrassed on Monday night, O-line was fine. So let them work it out and it'll be perfect.
Yeah, I think if we're going to look at, okay, so what do the Vikings need? Well, matchups that are poor, I guess, for both of them, looking at stats and things like that. The Vikings give up the eighth most yards to wide receivers. Their secondary does. And it, as much as a glaring problem that might be, the Saints give up the seventh most yards to wide receivers. So it's definitely something that both quarterbacks could take advantage of if, you know, like Jake, you say, they can get the protection that they need. And they definitely, and that was the biggest thing watching that Green Bay game, is he didn't have the time that he had most of the year. And that was, he was under pressure, you know, the whole night, it felt like. You know, we've talked about Rhodes, Xavier Rhodes, quite a bit on this show. And
it's going to be all Rhodes.
I was kind of surprised to look at or to see the stat that, you know, he had that little shouting match or whatever with Zimmer in Seattle. And since then, which was week 13, since then, he has only played 43% of the snaps. You know, and this is a guy who was, you know, an all pro consensus, you know, best cornerback on the team, best cover corner. And he hasn't been part of half of the snaps on defense here lately. So he's one of those guys that's going to have to step up. He's going to. And they don't. It's not just him. They need, obviously, Trey Waynes to step up as well. and take care. And the one, no, I mean, everybody knows the one that you obviously have to know where they're at all time is Michael Thomas. You know, he set the single season receiving mark this year, didn't he?
I think he did. Yeah.
You know, and so the question is, if you can shut him down, it becomes then, well, who else can Breeze throw to? And he hasn't used a lot of other guys this year, which is probably why Thomas has set the record. But, you know, Alvin Kamara is really his only other big option, who had 81 catches this year, but only one receiving touchdown. That was it. I was kind of surprised on that. His other target was Jared Cook, the tight end, who only had 43 catches, but 9 of them for touchdowns. That's a pretty good ratio there. So that's what I think is going to be a tough matchup for both of them, if their secondary struggle like they have been all year against wide receivers. All right, so what did the Vikings need to do to win? I think for me, before I open up you guys, the thing that they need to do for me is they need to get some pressure on Breeze and make him feel uncomfortable. The Saints are allowing the third fewest sacks in this year, and Breeze is the second fastest quarterback release time from snap to throw. And so he does not allow for a lot of that. And our defense, as much as we'd like to think that our defensive line is elite, they're 21st in pressure rate against quarterbacks. And without blitzing, when they don't blitz, they only put pressure on 24% of the time, which is 31st in the NFL. So it's not a strong point for them. And Breeze is fantastic against the blitz. So, you know, who's going to step up on that line and make him feel uncomfortable, I guess, is the biggest thing for me that the Vikings are going to have to do to win. Jacob, what are some the keys that you think that they need to take care of to win?
Well, luckily we play at noon on Sunday, so that's a start, not having to put Kirk on a prime time game. So, I mean, other than that, I think when you look at these playoff games, the huge swings, when you get a pick six or a fumble recovery that gets the offense in the red zone, if we could find a way to somehow do that and find a way to pick off Breeze and make a statement early in the game, get some momentum going our way, because that's going to be the biggest challenge, is finding momentum. If we can turn the ball over and actually take advantage of it, actually score a touchdown off of the turnover, rather than kick away for 3 points, I think that'll be a major change in the game, in the positive for the Vikings.
Getting touchdowns instead of settling for field goals that's huge.
Yeah. I mean, what game was it when? Was it Green Bay or against the Bears? I don't remember now which one it was, but we had all those turnovers, and I don't know if we got a single touchdown off of any of them. And just sitting there watching the game, it's like, guys, come on. I mean, this is where you put teams away. And if we're able to do that, you know, we need to we got to deflate the dome, you know, the New Orleans dome, take some air out of it and give us some momentum. So
quiet the fans a little bit.
Thing, the big play. We need that big play to go our way from the very get-go.
Okay, Ethan, what do you think that are some keys for the Vikings to win?
They have to deal with Cameron Jordan, who I think is third in the league with sacks. They're going to have to score. I think right now they're number 8 in the league with 25, just under 25 and a half points per game, which isn't terrible, but they're dealing with Drew Brees and the Saints. So they're going to have to easily score 35 points to continue.
Saints are averaging 36 right now.
Yeah. Okay, is that what it is? I think they're going to have to put up points. It's going to be high 30s to see a close game in the end. And I think it's just going to start off with the O-line and Cook, like I said earlier, getting hot and then translating any way they can, getting points on the board, whether that's turnovers or just going back and forth, scoring with them. I mean, at some point, someone's going to have to get a stop. But who's going to step up defensively is going to be their key. And then handling New Orleans defense, which I think is going to be the biggest key in the game, is when Kirk Cousins gets on the run and he's running for his life and Cook's not being effective, it's game over. So that's going to have to be the big thing for the Vikings, is getting the front guys stopped for New Orleans.
Well, I think a big thing, and we haven't talked about this either, is that the Vikings have really, really struggled to get off the field on third downs this year, which has really been a change from them the last couple of years. You know, 2 years ago in 17, they set the all-time record for, you know, they got 25% conversion rate on third downs. So one out of every four times the team was in third down, they were successful. You know, that's amazing. Last year was 30%. This year it's all the way up to 40%. You know, so they were really struggling getting off the field on third down. And that extends drives and your defense is on the field longer, and it doesn't usually lead to good things. So the last thing before I get your picks, and I want to ask you, what does Cousins himself need to do? Because he's going to be a focus. You know, he's never won a playoff game. He struggles in prime time. Everybody knows these things. What does he need to do? You know, he since week five has been fantastic. You know, take the couple, you know, the Green Bay game out of there maybe. But he's been great. Since week five, he's the second in yards per attempt. He's second in completion percentage. He's fourth in passer rating. So he's had, you know, post those, you know, those first four games or whatever, that two of them didn't go very well. He's been great, you know. So can he roll over? I mean, can he use that success or you know what he's had to hopefully get past the mental part of it, you know, the mental blocking part of it, where he knows the whole world is talking about the fact that he hasn't won big games. So what does he need to do, do you think, to be successful, Ethan?
He said he needs to feed off of what his other player is going to do for him. He's not going to go out there and win the game himself. He's just not that type of player. So he's just going to have to take what's given to him, both by the defense and what's given to him by offensive players for Minnesota. And that's just being able to take advantage of it. I mean, that's it. He's going to have to make the big plays when they're given the opportunity. And it's doing what he's been doing all season. And I think, like I said, Cook and the play action is going to be the biggest thing.
Jake, I know you're a big Cousins fan. What do you think he needs to do?
Yeah, King Kirk, he's my guy. we paid him the big bucks to step in here and bring us to the Super Bowl. And this is where it starts. So this is his first chance with the Vikings to take a stab in the playoffs. So this is what we're paying him for. So our expectations are very high, but, you know, simplifying it down, it's you know, get that first down on the opening drive. Doesn't have to be anything brilliant. You know, like Ethan said, get the play action going. Just find that little bits and pieces of momentum. Build that confidence throughout the first quarter. If we throw up some duds in the first few drives, it might continue on and get ugly. But if Kirk can just keep things simple, not let his head get to it, he'll end up making the big play when we need it to, late in the game if we need it.
Yeah, it's really, really, I agree with you. It's really important to get to right away. You got to get going right off the bat. You can't wait around, especially in that.
It would be huge if he could hook it up with Thielen early in the game. You know, Thielen's been nowhere to be seen. Well, he was injured for, 6 weeks or so, and just the last 2 weeks. He's
played 10 games this year. He has 30 receptions and six touchdowns, and that's it.
I mean, that'd be a huge confidence booster. You know, Thielen's a big part of that offense, and he has been in the last few years, so. Finding that connection, you know, Diggs will be there when you need him. So,
okay. Well, why don't you give us what's your final pick then? What's your score and how do you kind of see it playing out? How do you see it playing out, at least, I guess?
Well, like I said, we can't settle for field goals. We got to get the touchdowns when we're close. So I'm going to roll with a Vikings victory, of course, with 31 points for the Vikings, and we're going to shut them down solid. We're gonna keep New Orleans to 17 points, so 31-17, Vikes.
That's a bold prediction right there.
It's a statement game, Corey.
I wouldn't be unhappy with that.
This is where we roll.
All right, Ethan, what's your pick?
I'm a little bit on the opposite side of the spectrum in every aspect of it. I think New Orleans is just too good, and I know I get a little flack being Green Bay, but I think analytically, New Orleans is just going to be too much with Drew Brees, Hall of Fame, with all the weapons that he has. I'm going New Orleans at home, big win, 45-28.
Wow. That's okay. All right, well, then I'm going to find that happy medium. Not really happy, but I'm going to find the medium there. I have the final score at 38-28 Saints. And it's not necessarily a knock on the Vikings or, you know, Cousins, anything like that. The Saints are my pick to win the Super Bowl this year. I just think that they're playing that well right now, and they have all the weapons, and they have the motivation. You know, the last 2 years have not ended well for them in the playoffs. And, You know, I see them coming out and ready to roll tomorrow. And I hope that, you know, what Jake said is correct and that the Vikings can come out right away and put some points on the board and not let things get out of hand early. Because I think if you don't, if you have a turnover here, you have two or three really bad drives to start and they score a couple touchdowns, that it's going to be too late. So yeah, I have it 38-28. All right. About less than 5 minutes left here in the segment. So what I wanted to do really quick from you guys is to get your picks for the weekend. The Houston game just is finished now, so we won't make picks for that one. But Tennessee, New England, who do you have that one, Jake?
Well, New England will probably win, but I'd love to see Tennessee pull it out.
All right, so Seattle, Philadelphia, who you got in that one?
Seattle, easily. It blows my mind that the Eagles are even a favorite in this game.
Seattle's favored by 1.5, but yeah, it's not a big spread.
Oh, so that turned.
Yeah, and I think that has more to do with their lack of running game now with Carson's out and things like that. Okay, so then that's your picks for the weekend. What are your picks for the playoffs overall? Super Bowl, AFC, NFC?
Well, as much as I wanted to see the Vikings and the Bills, that dream's already dead, considering they just lost. But my next favorite pick will be Chiefs-Vikings. I think Mahomes is probably the most exciting person to watch. I think they're at a point where they deserve it. They deserve to be in the Super Bowl as long as the Vikes do. So,
you have the Vikings beating them in the Super Bowl then?
Obviously.
The bold predictions keep coming up.
There's no other way around it. That's why we brought Kirk Cousins here, to win the Super Bowl.
All right, so Ethan, what do you got, Tennessee and New England?
I want to say Tennessee too, but it's Tom Brady. And this is his first wild card appearance since 2009.
Yeah.
And I just don't think Tennessee has enough. New England by 2 touchdowns.
2? Seattle, Philadelphia?
Seattle by, I mean, easy. 3 touchdowns. Maybe Philadelphia can score a garbage time touchdown.
All right. And your overall AFC, NFC?
Baltimore over San Francisco.
Okay.
2 top seeds. Baltimore wins. It'll be a not flat. I mean, there won't be a whole lot of good things for San Francisco, I don't think. I think Lamar Jackson scores 4 touchdowns and they win by 30.
Okay. I have New England beating Tennessee 31-21. I have Philadelphia beating Seattle 21-17 in Philadelphia. Wentz is playing well right now, and that's not a fun place to play, I don't think, especially when it seems like Russell Wilson's going to have to do most of it himself. And then my pick for the Super Bowl, I have New Orleans over Baltimore, although I would like to see Kansas City in there too. I think it'd be fun to see Mahomes, but I have just because Baltimore has the home field all the way through, I think it'll be them out of the AFC. So, all right. Any final thoughts as we get ready for noon tomorrow? Jake, anything that you're going to be watching for?
No, man, it's going to be awesome. Going to order some pizza. I have a couple friends over. It'll be super fun. So, I think when the Vikings win the Super Bowl this year, that you'll probably have to change the name of your podcast to maybe this year. So
we will. We'll absolutely do that if that happens. Ethan, any final thoughts on the Vikes Saints for you?
Nope. I hope it goes well, but that is why we call it maybe next year, and we'll look ahead to 2021 after this weekend.
All right. Well, Jake, thanks a lot for joining us. Nice to have a positive Vikings fan on. And we'll hopefully talk to you again soon.
All right, take it easy. Thanks.
Thanks. Hi, welcome back to Maybe Next Year, our second segment tonight. We're going to talk about the Twins. Finally, the first time this offseason, made some actual significant moves. I guess it depends on how you define significant, but they signed 2 pitchers on the same day. Rich Hill, former Dodger, left-hander, tall, lanky left-hander, will be 40 years old by opening day. Signed him to a 1-year contract, base of $3 million, but he can earn as much as $12.5 million in incentives, which I thought was pretty crazy. And all he has to do to meet those incentives is start 15 games and throw 75 innings to up it from $3 million to $12.5 million. So he's got should have a lot of motivation to get healthy as fast as possible and contribute. But it's not quite as simple as that, because last year he only threw 58 innings before he went off and had some elbow problems, and he kind of had what they called a modified Tommy John. I'm not 100% sure what a modified Tommy John is. I know that regular Tommy John is at least a year, right, Dave, before you even can get back to that. And so joining us again, just regular at this point in time, Dave Scogan. Dave, thanks for coming on for the Twins and Gophers here.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
And then the other move that they made was signing Homer Bailey, 33-year-old pitcher last year. He's been kind of all over the place. He was drafted in 2004, all the way back in 2004. He was the seventh pick to Cincinnati. He was kind of a one of those big young studs that everybody was looking forward to. Came up when he was 21 years old and didn't really necessarily pan out a whole lot there in Cincinnati. His deal is one year for $7 million. So not a ton of commitment time-wise or money-wise by the Twins with those two signings. Bailey has a career ERA of 4.57. He has thrown two no-hitters. I forgot about that. I thought he'd thrown two no-hitters. He had Tommy John in 2015, came back from that and really, really struggled. In 2018 was 1-14 with a 6.09 ERA in 20 starts. And then last year kind of had a rejuvenating, it was kind of out of nowhere. It was pretty impressive. He started the year with Kansas City, had a good enough first half that he ended up being a trade chip at the trade deadline and moved to Oakland, where he threw really well. Ended the year 13-9 with a 4.57 ERA, which is his exact average over his career. The 13-9, 4.57 might not necessarily jump off the page to anybody, but if you were to compare that, and this is a little bit interesting, if you were to look at Kyle Gibson's numbers last year, he was 13-7 with a 4.84 ERA. So it feels like you're replacing one with the other. Pretty similar arms. Before we get in a little bit about each of them and what they're capable of possibly doing, Dave, what did you think of the moves with Bailey and Hill?
Well, to me, Bailey is your typical twin signing. 1 year, $7 million for a veteran who, has been around the block. He's not going to be terrible for you, but, he's not going to be a world beater either. I don't mind it. I wish they would have maybe went for somebody with a little more upside. I keep mentioning Taiwan Walker. He's still sitting out there. Maybe he's wanting more money than anybody's willing to give him. But I don't hate the signing of Bailey, but, it's just blah to me. It fills a roster spot. It fills a rotation spot, but it doesn't do a whole lot. Rich Hill, I do like the signing. Assuming he can get back and produce the way you hope he does. You look back through history here, and when he has pitched, he has been pretty dang good. His ERA has been fantastic over his career. Big nasty curveball. He's a guy that, especially come the back end of the season and come playoffs, he's got some experience. I believe recently him and his wife were just kicked out of a football game. He got into a scrap with security guards, so maybe he's got a little fire this team could use, come postseason time. So I like the Hill signing. Low risk, possible very high reward if he pans out.
Yeah, Ethan, any thoughts on those two before I kind of give you a little details on them?
A little bit older. I get they're kind of around. Coming in right into the league in 05 and 07, I'm just not sold that they're going to change anything. It was not a blockbuster move. It wasn't a blockbuster signing. Like you said, it was all short-term, short money. I don't know if it was just listening to the fans and finally getting something. I don't know. I'm not sold that's not the answer to a World Series. If the Twins were looking for something here in the offseason, they haven't struck gold. There is possible upside, like you said, but this isn't going to win a World Series with these signings.
No, it's not. And I think that, and Dave, we talked pretty much immediately when the moves were happening, that it was a typical Twins move is what it felt like. It just felt like there's a new regime in charge, but it felt like a move that the old regime would have made under Terry Ryan. I think if they could, the term that they use going into the offseason is that they wanted to make a move with impact pitching, impact pitching being the thing that they were really in bold letters or whatever. I think if they could go back, they might want to take that back, that statement, because they haven't done that. This is not impact pitching. There is definite upside. I think Bailey has some upside as well. He kind of changed his career within the last year or two when he started using his split finger more. His split finger was nasty last year. Threw it about 25% of the time, and hitters hit 182 off of it with a 38% whiff rate, which is pretty good, you know, with a split finger. And you hear about that from time to time, older pitchers maybe learning a new pitch like that and, it, you know, rejuvenating their career. You remember Roger Clemens, Dave, with the introducing the split finger was kind of his, well, that and the steroids, but together, it was a nice combination. So maybe you have something there. And we've talked about Wes Anderson before, and maybe he's somebody that can get a hold of a guy like that and help him along the way as well. Rich Hill, like we were saying, off air or whatever, he's kind of known for having a filthy curveball. Big, tall, lefty, lanky, and a crazy spin rate. Just some numbers that I found on him that I thought were really interesting. He's in the 95th percentile in curve spin rate, 98th percentile in exit velocity, which means that he's getting really weak contact. Hitters have really weak contact against him. And then 91% in fastball spin rate too. So it's not just the curveball that has the good movement on it. It's his other pitches as well. His fastball is, you know, sits right around 90 miles an hour. It's not going to blow by everybody, but when you have some really effective off speed, it makes that 90 miles an hour look like about 95. He spent most of his career kind of as a middle reliever, and then just within the last 4 or 5 years moved to the starting spot. In the last 4 years, he's 39-19 with a 3.0 ERA. You were saying, Dave, that his ERA has been really, really good. Albeit he's in the National League, so that helps a little bit, but his ERA last year in 13 starts was 2.45. But he only threw 58 innings. So it was kind of a, you know, a small sample size. He had 15 starts and got to see a little bit there, but they don't think with the modified Tommy John, he's probably going to be ready until late June, early July, if all goes well as planned. And it's hard, you know, with a 40-year-old sometimes to be able to know exactly how he's going to react to the injury and things like that. But, you know, if you see him, Dave, how do you kind of see the rotation shaking out now, at least let's say April?
Yeah, to start the season, I think you're going to see what Arizzi probably won, maybe Berrios won, you know, one, two of those two guys. And then I assume you're probably going to see Bailey three. That's just my hunch based off of experience, and then Dobnik Smeltzer. I think I can't remember exactly how far Pineda's still out for at least a month, if not more.
31.
I see him sliding into a three spot once he's back. But, you know, you're talking probably a good month to two before he's back, I think, still.
Is it 31 games, maybe?
That sounds about right. So, yeah, he's going to miss, you know, six, seven times for the rotation.
Yeah, and maybe April with weather and stuff like that, hopefully you don't need that fifth starter a whole lot. You know, if you're looking at Smeltzer and Dobnik, you know, Smeltzer was 2-2 last year, 3.86 ERA. Dobnik, who everybody, you know, knows him and knows his story, and obviously he started game two in the Yankee series, was 2-1 with a 1.59 ERA. So maybe he has a little bit of a leg up on Smeltzer in that. And maybe if you need that fifth starter once every other week or whatever it is, you can go with whoever's not in line in you know, the minor leagues that day or that week or whatever it is. But okay, so maybe a little bit of a clearer picture now with the rotation, even though maybe it's not a picture that a lot of people were hoping for. The name that we've talked about, you know, the last few weeks as it keeps coming up, and I think a lot of Twins fans are really kind of holding their breath to see what happens, is Josh Donaldson. And the news did come out this week that the Twins had made him a 4-year offer, and that there was only two other teams that made him a 4-year offer. You know, he's 34 years old. There might've been some other teams that were looking at him, but maybe didn't want to commit. But the numbers that they had kind of in that range were somewhere between like 4 years and $90 to $100 million, which is a huge commitment for, you know, a team like the Twins. The Braves and the Nats were the only two other teams that, according to the reports, were willing to give him that much of a commitment. So if we find out in the next week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, whatever it is, Dave, how do you see this Donaldson thing playing out?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I just saw in the last couple hours, St. Paul Pioneer Press had put out that the Twins are now pessimistic about their chances and are considering moving on from what I had read, Donaldson is basically sitting on going anywhere who's going to offer him $110 million. I know the Twins are at $100 million, is from what I believe I'd heard. I'm still hoping it works just because I'd love to see him in the lineup, fitting in with everybody else and moving Snow over to first. It's going to solidify their defense a little bit better, and adding him into the lineup would be a massive boost into an already, you know, lethal lineup last year. Personally, though, I just don't see it. I just don't see him adding the extra $10 million. I don't see it happening, unfortunately, but I guess cross your fingers and hope. They keep saying they're gonna make a splash, you know. This would be their chance to make a splash. At some point, to get somebody in Minnesota, they're going to have to overpay somebody. It just seems to be the trend. We're flyover country. It just seems time and time again. These guys are wanting to go East Coast, West Coast. They're going to have to, at some point, overpay somebody just to get them to come to town. Just don't see it happening this time, though.
That's a great – I mean, that's 100% right. To get people to come to the Midwest, teams like this – I think that makes it worth a little bit more to pay the money, even if they aren't worth that much to somebody in California or New York. That's what it's going to have to be. And it seems like there's money to be spent here. I don't understand. There has to be some point where you pull a trigger on somebody. Josh Donaldson's just as good as anybody else. If you're going to spend the money, I don't see why not.
I think, I don't know, looking at it, obviously you're hopeful. My at least, I guess being hopeful is that they will take this failure, at least what fans consider probably to be a failure in their lack of being able to sign some impact, quote unquote, impact pitching, as a consolation then. Okay, well, we didn't get done what we said we were going to in the pitching aspect of it. Let's maybe overpay, you know, $10 million or whatever it is to have that big signing that, you know, rejuvenates the fan base a little bit and lets them know that we're not just, you know, going to be okay with the status quo, you know, and winning. It's one thing to win 102 games, but that's not what last year's going to be remembered for. You know, it's going to be remembered for the failure in the postseason. So I don't think fans are going to be happy with just another, you know, if they win the ALC, the AL Central, and end up going 2-3 or whatever it is again next year. You know, so maybe hopefully if we're talking about ticket sales and all that kind of stuff, I think Donaldson would be a great move. And if you sell that many more season tickets and you have that, you know, many more people buying Twins gear and Donaldson jerseys and stuff like that, does that make up for the extra $10, $20 million right there? You know, I don't know how that necessarily works, whether that's the way it would or not. But okay, so then the other question when we talk about the Twins is trade options. And I'm always bouncing around looking at different things and people having different theories about stuff like that. And I came across a couple trade theories, or I don't know, wishful. It depends on how you look at it, I guess. But one of them was for Chris Archer. And I was going to ask you, Dave, what you thought about that.
Yeah, you know, I think the first show, that was one of the names I had on my list. And the guys, I don't know if I mentioned or not. Massive, massive upside. I believe in Pittsburgh, he has been a massive, massive failure. terrible ERA, walked a ton of guys, but he's got it there. I mean, you'd probably get him for cheap. You get him back to what he was doing when he was with Tampa Bay, missing bats, and the guy would be lights out again. So yeah, I mean, you get him for probably not a lot. I believe he's coming into a contract year in the next couple. I could be totally wrong on that, though. But for some reason, I'm thinking he's coming into a contract in the next couple. So you might be catching a guy at the right time. Who knows, he's got to put it together to make some money. So,
and the one that I was looking at, this one of the many sites or whatever, but Twins Daily has some good stuff on there from time to time. And they had a couple different scenarios and whether they were realistic or not. But they had Chris Archer for Brent Rooker and Nick Gordon. And I don't see that as a, you know, the Twins have always been kind of – They don't let prospects go in usually any situation. Another one that they had brought up was Brustar Graterol for Chris Sale, which I thought was interesting too. There's a couple other lower end names in there as well, and then some cash thrown in from the Red Sox. But I thought that was interesting. And I don't know if Chris Sale would be one that they'd be – I know they're trying to dump salary and things like that, but do you think that would be realistic?
Yeah, I mean, he's got to have a lot of buzz on him. Gratterall does. So if you think Sale can get you a couple of years here or even, you know, to buy in, you know, there's a window here, I feel, with the Twins before we start getting into some messy contract situations, especially with Berrios. I think they got him for a couple more years at, what, $650,000, which is yeah. crazy for as good as he is. Where they're going to have to start paying a lot of these guys. And so, I mean, a deal like that, yeah, you're mortgaging the farm on it, but you got a couple-year window. You're a Midwest team. They don't come around every year like the Yankees and some of these bigger cities can do. So he might make sense. He's got a blazing fastball. His arm is healthy right now. Doesn't mean it's going to be in 2 years. So maybe you take a gamble.
And that would be the number one indicator that would show you that maybe they are buying in that, okay, we got a window here of a couple of years to make a move like that. Cause Gratterall is obviously the future, but he's not there yet. And then the last one I was going to ask you about, cause I thought this was also something that was a good talking point, and that was the idea of a Noah Syndergaard trade for Byron Buxton and Alex Kirilloff.
Yeah, and same thing there too. Massive arm. He would be an absolute stud. He's shown he's for the most part been able to stay somewhat healthy. When he has pitched, he's been a workhorse. Buxton, on the other hand, has not. So you have a highly regarded prospect who just has not been able to put it together. He showed a lot of promise last year, but then again, he keeps running into the walls, and you know, it's hard to tell a guy not to play hard, but at some point he's going to get himself concussions to the point where he can't play either. So what good is he?
Kind of that running quarterback situation, you know, that's really talented, and you're trying to get him to slow down a little bit and think about a career as opposed to one play.
Yep. So it's tough. You know, if they did it, I don't think I'd be disappointed, especially with the outfield prospects the Twins do have. You know, they got quite a bit, even, you know, getting back to like Nick Gordon, that's a name we've been hearing for a long time. Well, all of a sudden Louis Arraez comes out of nowhere, and he's going to be in the lineup now for a couple of years. You got Royce Lewis, who you drafted number one overall. You hope at some point he, you know, pans out. So maybe a guy like Nick Gordon, you know, is expendable.
I think Nick Gordon's a lot more expendable than Alex Kirilloff or Brent Rooker. Because Gordon's been around for a while now, and they've waited for quite a while for him.
You know, I think if you move one of those guys, Rooker or Kirilloff, I think that tells you a lot of what you feel about Eddie Rosario for the future also. You know, if one of those guys is dealt, I think it's pretty clear that they're going to try and keep Rosario around because he's going to be possibly gone in the next, I think, year or two also, contract-wise.
Yeah, and we've talked about him I don't know how many times now because he's just been that fans either love him or think he needs to be unloaded, you know, and just based off of that's how much the baseball has changed to the analytical side of it, because here's a guy that hit 280, you know, and had 32 home runs and 107 RBIs, and people are saying, well, you know, his whiff rate is so high and he swings at everything, and you know, so 10 years ago people would have been looking to sign him for $100 million, you know. But okay, that's unless you have anything to add about the moves you'd like to see here in the next couple of weeks, Dave.
No, you know, trades, you know, Nolan Arenado is always out there. Seems like 50-50 shot of him getting dealt. That's a total pipe dream. But if you miss out on Donaldson, I mean, if you're going to sell the farm on another infielder or third baseman anywhere in the league, that would be the guy. But you know, that total pipe dream. And another thing, I guess, just random note, you know, the signing of Rich Hill, be interesting to see what that does with Smeltzer as far as his tutor-ish type guy.
Yeah.
You know, if he can pick up some things, you know, he's a definite off-speed, you know, keep the guys guessing type of pitcher. If he can pick some stuff up from Hill, that might really improve his game down the road too. So,
Ethan, anything that you'd like to see here?
Nope.
Pinkies?
You guys are the experts.
Expert is probably not the right word, but... we'll wrap that up for the Twins, and we'll come back with a little bit about Gopher football. Welcome back to Maybe Next Year, our third segment here. We're going to talk about the Gopher football team, probably for the last time for a while since they've now wrapped up their season, but what a great way to end it. What a great last thing to talk about with them for the season. They had probably one of the biggest wins in program history, in the Outback Bowl on January 1st against Auburn. Just a little kind of brief summary before I kind of get you guys' reactions on it. The Gophers won 31-24. Although the stat line would not show that. If you were to look at the stat line and not the final score, you would think there was no way it was that close. The Gophers dominated in every sense, really from the start. So after a bad first possession, Tanner Morgan threw a kind of an ugly pick, and setting the tone for it, it was an ugly pick. They got the ball back right around the 20-yard line, I think, their own 20-yard line, and they held them out of the end zone just for a field goal, and I think that was kind of where everything got kick-started, gave them a lot of confidence there, and they kind of rolled and went into halftime with a 24-17 lead, and then they changed. Auburn tied it up in the third with a touchdown, and then Gophers took the lead for the final time on a great bomb pass from Tanner Morgan to Tyler Johnson for 73 yards, and that was it. And then they had a great final stand at the end of the game to hold him off. So Tanner Morgan went 19 for 29, 278 with two touchdowns and that one pick. Had a very good game to top off a great season for him. Best season a Minnesota quarterback's had in quite a long time. Seth Green, the Wildcat quarterback, finally threw his first pass out of the Wildcat of the whole year. I've waited for it all year. They've ran the Wildcat in so many goal line big spots, and I just keep waiting. I kept waiting and waiting. Okay, when are they going to pull the Tebow? When are they finally going to? And they did. They finally used it. They waited till the last game of the year, and it worked perfectly. Bo Nix, the Auburn quarterback, the freshman who everybody's been talking about all year, obviously, and for good reason. You can see the upside. Had a so-so game, 17-26 for 176 and a touchdown, but he never, it didn't feel like he ever really got going. He had one really good drive, and other than that, made some mistakes and stalled, and Morgan looked like the better quarterback in the end of it. Not just a great day for Tanner Morgan, but also for Muhammad Ibrahim. Running back, had 140 yards on 20 carries and a TD. And the big story was Tyler Johnson, the wide receiver, the senior wide receiver, had 12 receptions for 204 yards and two touchdowns. And his final game became the all-time leading receiver in yards and touchdown receptions, which was really kind of a cool thing to see him go out on. Ibrahim and Morgan both will be back next year. Johnson will be drafted probably in the first two rounds. I don't know if that's what you'd read, Dave, or not, but that's kind of what I saw him as. But they have their next best receiver, Rashad Bateman, coming back as well. So there's a lot of really, there's a lot of hope for the future and a lot of really good names coming back. The big question will be about Antoine Winfield Jr. He has another year of eligibility left, but he was an All-American this year. And, talk as he would probably go in the first two rounds as well if he decides to declare. So that'll be a wait and see what he decides to do there. But, okay, so I guess kind of, Dave, I know you watched it through as well. As you were there, seeing it all play out, what were some of your thoughts on the game?
With bowl games, I guess the first thing, I kind of pumped the brakes a little bit just because of you got the big layoff, and it just seems so many games where teams come out flat. They a couple weeks ago, I think I said if they kept it within 7 points, you should consider it a win. The way this one shook out, for the most part, Auburn had most of, I think, all their players playing. The Gophers actually were missing the big fella, Falali or whatever, however you pronounce his name. He didn't play. Mm-hmm. And I think one of their key defensive guys didn't play. And for the most part, they physically dominated the game from start to finish. You look at their rushing yards, they put up 215 yards, the most Auburn gave up the entire season. And they held Auburn to the least amount of yards rushing the entire season. So up front, they dominated both sides of the ball. They tore Auburn apart through the middle of the field, especially in the passing game. Johnson earned himself a heck of a lot of money on that game. Just being a lot better athlete than a lot of the defensive backs that were up against him. You take the Big Ten SEC bias, and they totally flipped it on its face. So it was a hell of a win. It was a statement win, not only for the Gophers, but I guess for kind of the conference too. because they totally outplayed a really, really good football team. And even though the scoreboard only showed a 7-point win, you know, it basically, if you watch the game, it felt like a lot wider margin than that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess I'll clarify for you, because you said that Auburn are a great football team, and they really are. Looking at what they've done this year, you know, they beat Oregon early on, top 10 team, pretty close to making the college football playoff there if it wouldn't have been for a late scuffle. Their losses were to Florida, who was a top 10 team at the time, by 3 points to LSU, who was playing for the national title, and then to Georgia by 7 points, you know, who just played in a New Year's Six Bowl. And they beat Alabama 48-45. You know, so that and their defense was what was so vaunted, too. And so for the Gophers to outrush them, you know, 215-56 was just incredible to watch. So, yeah, like you said, it really, I think that made it even more special, being that it was such a good Auburn team. And you know, we'd obviously talked a lot about, you know, what would have happened had the Gophers pulled out the Iowa game, you know, and ended up in the Big Ten title game against the Ohio State. And everybody talking about, well, they would have been drilled into the ground. And maybe that's true. But now watching how they played against what we would call a blue blood SEC team, there's no reason to think that they couldn't have held their own, you know, if they would have played like that, not just against Ohio State, but, you know, who they would have matched up there if they would have matched up afterwards. So, I mean, do you see that as some kind of indication a little bit, Dave, about some of the things that we talked about with them early in the year?
Yeah, you know, I think big time. You know, the way this ends for me is the biggest thing. Now you're going into the offseason with arguably even a bigger win than the Penn State win. You know, and it, you know, I'll kind of get to it later when we talk, but to see the celebration, I think I'd mentioned it to you right after the game, we were texting back and forth, the celebration on the sidelines was like they'd won the conference championship.
Yeah.
That you could tell those kids had bought in from the last game to this point. They had busted their butt and put everything into it. And it was a celebration like you don't usually see at the end of a random bowl game, I guess. So they were all in, and you could tell they were a focused bunch, and they came to play and they took care of it.
So what stood out to you, Ethan?
It was everything. I mean, Johnson, 12 for 204, like you said, 2 touchdowns. Morgan played great. I mean, it was just they went in there and they took care of business, and you kind of wondered, well, we dropped two. We didn't want to be. This isn't where we wanted to be. Even though they got their big game, and given the Outback Bowl is not the place where you want to do it, but they got their big game against a big team, and they knocked around an SEC team, a good SEC team, like you said. So I think it's great that they got to finish the year like that, and then the seniors got to finish it the way they did. And like you said, Johnson earned himself a lot of draft stock value, and he's going to go someplace and get some good money. But yeah, it was minus the 96-yard kickoff return by Auburn. I think It was a pretty well played game by Minnesota, and I think they deserved it. And I think hopefully it's going to roll into coming years where, like you said, a lot of young guys that are already around for this right now that are bought in, sold in, and it's only going to get better while this continues. And that's what the program needed.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of goes into what we're going to, you know, ask you here in a sec, but you know, Fleck talked about, you know, if we want to be a blue blood team, we have to beat, you know, a blue blood team, which maybe felt like it before the game, kind of a ridiculous statement. But, you know, he made the point that the Gophers used to be a blue blood, you know, 40s, 50s, 60s, long time, you know, before any of us remember were around. But and to get back to that, you have to have statement wins like these. And something that really stood out to me was when they had the 7-point lead. Towards, you know, in the last part of the fourth quarter, they had a 16 play, 68 yard, 8.5 minute final drive to run out the clock, which, you know, that tells you everything you know about where, how far that they'd come and to be in a situation like that and to have that much poise and some really interesting calls on offense, some gutsies. And I guess you can make those a little bit more gutsy calls sometimes in bowl games when, you know, national title's not on the line. But, you know, they had that 4th and 1 at the 40, at their own 41-yard line, you know, where you could, with about 4 minutes left, where you punt and you try and play defense, they went for it, and they ran a little quick tight end dump pass, and Bryce Witham, I think, made just an amazing one-handed falling catch, and that showed you a lot about where, how far that they've come to be able to have a drive like that and do what they did, you know, and it puts them to, a final record of 11-2. It's the first 10-win season since 1904, when Teddy Roosevelt was president. I had to put that in there. But yeah, I mean, it was so it ended a really great season, ended on a great note. The question that I was going to ask then is, what do you think this means for kind of the program going forward? And I guess the PJ Fleck question then is, how much credit does he deserve for what's taken place and what's unfolded this year? Dave?
You know, I got to say, he deserves a fair amount of credit. You know, this is kind of what he said he was going to do and what he envisioned, and it's coming to fruition. You know, you see the way those kids, how hard they play, and you get the feeling that they'd run through a brick wall for the guy. And you watch his passion on the sideline, especially when he on live television was cursing out that official there in the fourth quarter with five curse words in a row. you get the feeling that he'd do it for them also. And I think, you know, the guy's kind of a psychological mastermind with everything he says. Everything is calculated. But you get the feeling more and more as you see the guy more and more that it is just him, and it's real. It's not just some made up thing. It's actual true passion that he has for these kids and for the program. So the kids have bought in, you know, the fans clearly bought in, you know, right after the curse word barrage on the sideline, they show the fans in the crowd, and you get all these 40, 50-year-old Midwesterners making an airboat rowing motion. You know, it's the funniest thing ever, but it shows that they're into it. You know, they're there, they're buying in, and they've developed now a following and a fan base. And with that is going to come money, and it's going to come, you know, expectations. But it's putting them on the map real quick, and I think a lot quicker than anybody probably expected it to go this fast.
Yeah, I definitely think it's probably coaches always come in to make those promises about, well, you know, we're going to turn this around in 2-3 years or 3-4 years, and be a Rose Bowl contender and stuff like that. And as Gopher fans or Minnesota sports fans in general, I think we just kind of nod our head and laugh a little bit at the, you know, here comes, you know, another one making the same kind of, you know, claims and things like that. But it has been incredible to watch how quickly things did change this year, especially after the nail biters they had in the first four games against pretty middle of the road teams. So, and their schedule next year, probably their conference schedule probably isn't going to be quite as easy. They'll probably get, you know, they didn't see Michigan this year. They didn't see Ohio State, obviously, you know, so there's some possibility that there might be some a little bit tougher conference schedule. But okay, so the last thing I'll ask you before your favorite moment, I wanted to ask, what impact do you think this has on the Big Ten? Does it have an impact, this game, at all on kind of the outlook of the Big Ten, Ethan?
I think so. Obviously, just what they did all around was enough for it to stand on for both them and the conference. But to do it against, like we talked about, an SEC team, a good SEC team, I don't think it's a knock on, well, SEC has fallen off the map here, because they still obviously have enough power teams on what they're doing. I think it speaks monuments to the Big Ten and what's going on there. And maybe the little guys like Minnesota are stepping up and like, hey, we're going to compete now. Whether you're SEC, ACC, it doesn't matter anymore. We're going to come in. We've done it. And they're going to hopefully continue to do it. So I think it puts Big Ten, it's moving them up in the right direction, obviously. And I think it speaks statements for them.
I think it would have been big if Michigan would have been able to pull off a game against Alabama that was going at the same time. And it looked for a while like it was going to be pretty close. And then Alabama kind of put it away at the end. But all right. So then we'll kind of wrap up the Gopher season and all that, just taking a look back at what your guys' favorite moments were of the year, and then kind of what you're looking forward to next year as we get going. I can just give you mine first, that way we're all kind of can go different directions with it or whatever. But obviously there were a lot of really great things that happened, a lot of things that happened that haven't happened in a long time, with wins and you know, these things first. But really what was the coolest moment for me was in the Rutgers game, when Casey O'Brien was able to come in and hold for a couple extra points. You know, and if you don't know the Casey O'Brien story, please go ahead and check it out. You know, Google him. Four-time cancer survivor, was told he wasn't going to play football ever again, and just a great story. Was able to come out and hold some points for them. And I think that whether you like Fleck or not, whether, you know, you buy his gimmick or not, I think that kind of goes along with what you were saying, Dave, that it shows just how much he cares about the players, and they kind of vice versa, you know. So, yeah, the Casey O'Brien moment was probably my favorite. What about you, Ethan?
Like, my favorite individual moment was the Penn State game. 101 left, Penn State's driving. At their time, they were number 4 in the nation. Pickoff in the end zone, steal the win. Morgan played great. He was 18 for 20, 3 touchdowns, over almost 350 yards. Overall, a great game, but individually, I think that was a great moment for me, was the pickoff in the end zone to steal it.
Yeah, that was a great moment. Dave?
Yeah, I just think that, you know, the culmination of the second half of that Auburn game, you know, just sitting there watching it, and you could see, you know, the tension building, and the fourth down conversion with the great catch, and you could see the excitement on the players' faces, on the coaches' faces, you know, that they were going to do this. Personally, my favorite moment was actually the air rowing in the crowd. That absolutely made me laugh out loud. And then chanting of the row, which is clearly going to happen now on 4th and 1, I think, forever. They're just going to start chanting row, row, row. But, you know, just a culmination of the buildup and the preparation, and to see those guys jacked up with a win going into the offseason now to continue to work hard. I think Morgan even made the comment after the game, like a half hour after the game, that it starts over right now. Mm-hmm. So these guys are already looking ahead to next year and open to do big things.
Yeah, so that's the final thing I'll ask. And I think we can probably agree that they're going to open the season as a top 10 or top, at the very least, top 15 team, based on everything that they have coming back. What are you looking forward to most next season then, Dave?
Yeah, you know, in the Winfield decision will be huge. I assume he's going to go pro. He's probably got every reason in the world to do so. But you look at it, they get their entire offensive line back. They got Ibrahim coming back. He's a stud. They got Bateman coming back. He's a stud. They get hit pretty hard on defense. I think they lose two of their three main linebackers. I think the one didn't play in the bowl game. They get their top 4 cornerbacks back. They get one of their safeties back. So, I mean, their defensive backfield is sitting pretty good. They've had a lot of injuries through the linebacker core the last couple of years, so it's not like they're not bringing anybody in who hasn't played. So, I mean, it's things are looking up. Like you said, a tougher schedule probably next year, which could get tricky. You know, I'm not going to sit here and say they're a Big Ten championship game lock, but it certainly helps in the division that they play in, where they don't have to deal on the same side with Ohio State and some of the bigger boys of the conference every year. But, you know, there's no reason that they can't see a top 25 at most finish. I think anything outside top 25 would be a massive failure for next year. Top 15, top 10 goal for sure. So,
absolutely. I think, yeah, at this point, you're asking yourself, why not college football playoffs? I know it's kind of a stretch, but what was done there, you were only a couple games away at the end of the day. And then you turn around, you end the year with a big win. I guess next year, looking ahead, it's I have a pre-schedule out. They go to Wisconsin, then they host Michigan, and I think that's going to be a big 2 games. And I want to see that's going to determine their kind of rest of the year. I think it happens right in the middle of their schedule. I want to see, obviously, redemption against Wisconsin, and then turn around. And
they avoid Ohio State again next year.
Yep. I believe that I want to see a big statement game against Michigan to solidify the fact that they belong. The end of the year, you never want to have a blemish in your loss column. It'll be tough not to, but them are going to be 2 defining games for next year that Minnesota is going to have to compete and win.
Yeah, thanks for pulling this up. The Big Ten schedule next year is Iowa at home, at Maryland, at Wisconsin, which is where they went. They finished the last year's against Wisconsin. So playing them in October will have a little bit different feel to it. But we know they can go to Wisconsin and win. They did it 2 years ago. And then that home game against Michigan, which could be, you know, really, even though it's October 17, that could be a deciding factor, because then they come back. They play Illinois, Michigan State, Purdue, Northwestern, and then finish at Nebraska. You know, and if they're playing well, those should all be games, you know, that you should take care of business. At least what we'll, I think, now expect based off of what's happened this year. And hopefully we're right in expecting that from them. So, all right. That'll wrap up the GOAF. So we'll come on back and give our final bold predictions for the week. Welcome back for our final segment here on episode 7 of Maybe Next Year. We're going to finish up with our bold predictions for the week. Before I get to your guys' bold prediction, Jake wanted to share, he wanted us to share his bold prediction at the end of the show. It's a fantastic bold prediction. And if it comes, comes true, it's the most amazing bold prediction that's ever been made. He predicts that Marcus Sherrills, who's been re-signed, everybody remembers Marcus Sherrills was a punt returner for a long time for the Vikes and was not with them this year, was signed for this week. And his prediction is that Marcus Sherrills will have a punt return for a touchdown against the Saints tomorrow. So it'd be a great prediction if it comes to fruition. So, Dave, what's your prediction?
I'm going to go with the Gopher basketball team. They got a big weekend coming up next weekend. They got Michigan State, I believe, at Michigan State, and then Michigan at home. I'm not going to go too bold because I'm not going to pick which one, but I do feel they are going to knock off one of those two teams for a pretty big Big Ten win.
Wow. I'm hoping Michigan State.
That'd be nice. I hope so, too.
Ethan, I dislike Larry. I dislike Izzo, so I hope you're right.
Yes, I'm with you there.
Timberwolves, my bold prediction is Timberwolves right now sit 13-21, 14.5 games back, and they've lost 7 of their last 10 games.
How far are they out of the playoffs? So they're only like a game.
They're only in 12th right now. They're a game and a half out of the playoffs. That's right now. Insane. I will still say they're going to make playoffs. My bold prediction is that they're going to flip it, and they're going to go 7-3 in their next 10 games, and they're going to be right back in the hunt. Second bold prediction is they're going to finish 7th in the conference.
Your Wolves bold predictions are poison. they haven't worked out yet, but I hope yours are true too. Mine then would be, what did we just say? Oh, my bold prediction is that Josh Donaldson signs either this week or next week, and that he signs with the Atlanta Braves. Once again, I hope that one doesn't come true, but that's just kind of where I see that heading right now, at least, especially if they're going to make a similar offer to the Twins. But all right, so that'll wrap us up for tonight. Thanks for listening. Be sure to check us out on Anchor and then Spotify. Our next show, what we're thinking, if the Vikings win tomorrow, the next show will then again be the day before their next playoff game, which would be their next Saturday or Sunday. If they do not win, we're just going to plan on going next Sunday and kind of getting hopefully back to a little bit of a regular schedule that way. So hopefully we're on a day or two early for a little Vikes preview. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yep, and thanks to Jake as well for joining us for that Viking segment. Ethan, thanks as well.
Always a pleasure.
Yep, always a pleasure. And we'll check you out next time for episode 8. Thanks for joining us.